Thanks, Mary Beth. Well, welcome everyone, and thank you all for coming. It's an honor to be here at one of my favorite historic homes in this Commonwealth. The staff here does such a great job. You have such a great house, such a great landscape, and so many great programs that it's really a pleasure for me to be here. So today I wanted to talk a little bit about Kentucky antiques, which can be defined in a lot of different ways. With me, I only do three-dimensional things. I'm not a painting or sculpture person, although we do have a couple painting and sculpture and works on paper people here in the room too. But I guess I need to explain the title a little bit. I think art is self-explanatory. These are great art objects. But there's also a lot of work to be done in understanding Kentucky antiques. You know, it's a field that has not been as widely published, certainly, as researched as, say, material from the East Coast. Now, there's a legion of people, we have a couple in this room, Warren and Julie Payne, a number of collectors, dealers, and others who really have led the way over the years, but there's still so much work to be done, and that's one of the things that I found so rewarding, you know, working on everything from acquisitions at the Speed to the clock exhibition that we have right now that I'll talk about near the end today. But there's just so much to discover. And it's in some ways so easy to discover because there hasn't been much research done. And that is really rare in the museum business anymore. So I love to talk about this material, and I hope I encourage all of you to love it too. So what I want to talk about today is really sort of the process I use when I am looking at material, whether that's in someone's collection, whether it's a potential acquisition for the museum or otherwise. And I have a very linear brain, and I tend to boil everything down to like 3 points, bullet points. As my colleagues can attest, they get emails from me that are like all bullet points. But really to think about caliber, condition, and context. So we'll look at each of those and how those apply to different kinds of objects. And all the objects we're talking about today are in the Speed's collection. So the sugar chest, you know, certainly the most iconic form associated with this state, to some extent with Tennessee and other parts of the South, but it's the piece when I talk to someone and they say, well, I'm not really interested in collecting, but boy, I want a sugar chest. I think that's because they do speak to this state and this region so much. You know, it's a form that evolved really in part out of the high cost of refined sugar, which isn't like the granulated sugar we get today. It came in these big, well, different sizes, rock hard cones. And the cost was due largely to transportation. You know, this was coming from the Caribbean and elsewhere. Getting it before the steamboat or before railroads to what was then America's first frontier, Kentucky, rapidly developing, of course, it was very expensive material. And so this form evolved to give it its due as kind of a status object. So sugar chests were forms that you'd find in a dining room or a parlor. And if you think about the way sugar was being used, it was tied up in rituals of sociability, whether you're having tea or coffee, or alcoholic punch. I think I'm going to have to come and try the punch. But sugar was being used in all of these kinds of things. And it did have also had this aura of sociability. So this is a piece I would love to have myself. It's one that's in our collection, part of the large gift of Bob and Norma No, some of the very important collectors of Kentucky material over the decades. It's a form, as you can see, a little less typical than you might expect with this large case, a simple hinge top with a few drawers, the drawers being used for, well, what do we use drawers for? A lot of things. But for things like tablespoons, teaspoons, you know, other sort of equipage that one assumes, napkins, those kinds of things that would have been part of the sociability of tea and coffee consumption. And this format, this kind of design is one that by and large seems to have connections to the Fayette County area, possibly also into Clark County and Montgomery County. So from the central part of the state. You know, I think it's a very interesting example of the type. I think as you start to look at more of the classic sugar chest form like this, This, to me, reads as a little more refined, a little more sophisticated in its proportions, the use of inlay as well. And this is really the classic version of the late 19th into the early, the late 18th into the early 19th century of the Kentucky sugar chess form, a box on a stand with a single drawer. And with this, you can see, too, where this form came from. It really came from what were called bottle cases, which looked almost exactly like this, that you'd store your glass liquor bottles and other things in. So it wasn't a leap to transition that form into storing things like sugar and tea and coffee. And the best. And the best is always critical as a curator might try to be, your own taste always enters into the equation. And I will plead guilty to that. This is one of my favorites in our collection. But when you think about it in the sort of stream of surviving Kentucky sugar chess, what makes it great? Again, the classic form, beautiful proportions, this profuse use, a very interesting inlay. You know, this is a half fan, you know, these devices above the legs, fairly standard. A little more unusual is this inlaid tree device. And you see similar devices to this turning up in Lincoln County and its vicinity. So it's sort of down near Dansville. But a beautiful example of the form. This one could date as early as 1805 and could be as late as, you know, the coming up on 1820 even. So ceramics. Salt glaze stoneware was one of the important early industries in the state. Much of it focused around Madison County, though it was happening elsewhere too, and we'll see an example from Maysville here in a minute. This is a great example. I would consider this good and maybe even a little better than good. Big, this is a 10 gallon, so it's, I jotted down the dimensions this morning, so it's, you know, it's like 20 inches, it's pretty good sized. If we saw it, we'd see that it had a little bit of elaboration of some cobalt being used to decorate where the handles are attached to the body. It, as these pieces so often did, it bears the name of its maker, Griggs and Grinstead, and the name Waco, Kentucky. So we know exactly where it was coming from. Lucian Griggs and probably a man named Smith Grinstead were the Griggs and Grinstead behind this, and dates to about 1860 or maybe into the 1870s. Part of that dating is based on that partnership of Griggs and Grinstead, but also the name Waco. Waco got a post office around 1860, so that became a formal place name. And this is the kind of form that would have been used to store all kinds of things. You know, my joke with these is that it was like the Tupperware of its age. It was very durable. You could store all kinds of things in it. You know, at this scale, who knows what kind of goods would have found their way into this as a storage vessel. This is a beautiful example, though not made in Kentucky, so why am I including it? You know, I think it's very important when we think of early Kentucky and its material culture that we think broadly about things that weren't just used here, but things that are made here, but things that were used and consumed here too. And we'll see that popping up with a few other examples that we'll talk about in a minute. But this was made by the Hamilton and Company Pottery of Greensboro, Pennsylvania, down in southwestern Pennsylvania, another very important pottery making center. This piece dates to about 1865 or so. And obviously what makes this wonderful is the amazing decor, including the eagle there on the bottom. See, it's a 4 gallon. But then it also bears the name of merchants, two brothers who were merchants in Maysville at that time, although one of them, I think it was Johnny McCarthy, ended up here in Louisville a little bit later on in his career. And the best. Why is this the best? Well, that's why. It's a remarkable object in so many ways. You know, here we have the mark of Isaac Thomas, a potter who was born in Mason County in 1789, so very early, and was working as a potter by at least 1830, and I have to believe probably a little earlier than that. A beautiful 4-gallon jar, nice cobalt decor, perhaps by one of the people working at Thomas's pottery rather than Thomas himself. And then this, Kentucky 1837. I mean, that says it all. It was made in Kentucky in 1837. I think the interesting aspect of part of Thomas's work is that this piece, and we have one other in the Speed's collection, have provenances taking them to Louisiana. So there's Isaac Thomas working up there in Maysville on the Ohio River, and his wares were finding their way down to Louisiana. You know, one wonders if they were filled with things. Were they? Was he just retailing his stoneware southward? We don't know that at this point. But I think the point of putting Kentucky 1837 on that, I mean, if it was someone in Maysville, well, they'd know it was Kentucky. I think it's part of the marking, the way he identified himself as the maker and the source of objects like these. So condition. Obviously, one of the things you always look at and want to evaluate very carefully is the condition of an object. The materials are part of that, as we'll talk about in a minute. Thinking about how objects are made is always a very important part of that. And I think compared to, say, American furniture made in New England in the late 18th or early 19th century, where there's so much of it, the condition expectations of that from a curatorial standpoint or from a collector standpoint, you expect it to be in better shape or be able to find great pieces that are in close to, I'm convinced there's no such thing as original condition, are close to their original condition. Whereas with Kentucky, the pool of surviving material is much smaller, so you tend to be a little bit more forgiving. But it's always important to know as a collector or as a museum, if you're acquiring something, to know what has happened to it, because that affects its value, and that becomes part of the negotiation over price, always. So let's talk about furniture. You know, the typical woods that we see in Kentucky furniture is the primary woods. The woods that you see are going to be cherry or walnut, by and large. There are certainly exceptions to that rule. Mahogany was available, we know, certainly in Lexington by at least 1807, if not earlier. Although at that time, in 1807, it was described as being quite dear. So in other words, rare and quite expensive. You, by and large, you'll start to encounter mahogany veneer becoming more common with Kentucky pieces by at least 1815, certainly by the 1820s. But cherry and walnut are still the woods that we encounter most often. And then when we look inside pieces, what's called the secondary wood, certainly the dominant wood that you see is going to be poplar. It grew here prolifically. It's great from the woodworker's standpoint. The trees grow very straight. They tend not to have a lot of knotting. We use it still to make crates for shipping art because it's, you know, it's technically a hardwood, but still a wood that's fairly easy to work. It's quite stable. And this is what you'll see. But having said that, you know, secondary woods, the woods that a cabinet maker was using on the inside of something, I mean, that was being driven by availability and price. What did they have available to them that was the least expensive that they were comfortable working with? So as a result, with Kentucky pieces, I've seen sycamore, I've seen yellow pine, I've seen white pine. Sometimes you'll see cherry and walnut being used inside pieces. That tends to occur a little bit earlier in, say, before 1820, although there are exceptions to that rule too. So when you look at the secondary woods, it will vary. I've seen a Kentucky sideboard that had white oak being used for the sides of its drawers, and that completely threw me for a loop because white oak isn't a wood you see very often being used inside Kentucky furniture, but lo and behold, there's an exception to every rule. And I think as we start to assess things, you know, I love dirt. I love objects that look like, and this piece is actually been lightly refinished, but you know, when you see this, That's a good sign. It means it hasn't been dipped and stripped. It hasn't been treated incredibly harshly over the decades, although it's very easy to refinish the flat surfaces and still have this kind of muck and grime going on. But I love to see that. And that's not something, if we acquire a piece, I'm not going to take that to conservator and say, clean all that out. I mean, that's just part of the evidence of history, of its age, of understanding it as something that is old and shouldn't look like it's brand new. I love to see normal wear and tear on something. This is actually a photo of the same piece of furniture as that last image I showed you. A beautiful desk and bookcase that was made in the Garrett County area, maybe in Madison County. But you can see, you know, this has a break at some point. But what did they do? They just stuck it back together. They didn't lop all the other legs off to make them short, to get rid of the break, and that happens a lot. They didn't just take the whole skirt and legs off and replace them. You know, they lived with it. And so all of that original material is still there. And as long as it's stable, as long as it's not going to fall down, just leave it be. And when you look at a foot of a piece of furniture or the bottom of the leg of a chair and you see this, you get a little worried. Look how crisp and clean that is. For something that should be 200 years old, do you expect it to look like that? It's been moved from home to home. It's had vacuum cleaners run into it. It's had, you know, had wax, mop wax on it. That's not what you want to see. And indeed, I know from this piece, you know, when Mr. and Mrs. Noe acquired it, the top of the case, we'll see a detail of it later, is such an amazing inlaid piece of furniture from Madison County, it was missing its legs. But again, it was such an important object that they were willing to forgive the fact that it was just a box at that point, that its legs were gone. And that's the kind of thing where you can put those back and give the piece the due that it really does deserve. When you look at furniture too, you know, you always want to start to look at areas like feet, which we just looked at, but other areas where you should expect bad things to have happened. And start to look at what kinds of things go on. This is the lid of a drop front desk. This one is from Madison County area. This one's in remarkably good condition. Why do I say that? Well, you can see it still has its lip. So you see that molded edge there? There's been some loss, a little bit of loss down here. The lip is still there. Oftentimes when those start to get chipped or broken up over time, they'll just get sliced off. Notice down here, I hope you all can see this. Notice down here, so the way this lid is constructed, which is fairly typical, is there's a center board with the figure of the wood aligned horizontally, and that's fitted into two styles or end pieces where the grain is running this way. So wood likes to shrink perpendicular to its figure. So what we see down here is that this piece is shrinking this way, this piece wants to shrink this way, and you can see there's an offset here. When this was first made, these pieces lined up perfectly. I guarantee you this gap would have been almost invisible, but you're seeing the evidence of that shrinkage of this board against this end cap, and that's a good thing. Hinges and lids, particularly with sugar chests or anything that has, like a blanket chest or other things where the lid opens and there's no lid support, what happens sooner or later? The lid goes over the back and you get tear outs. And that's what you're seeing here is a repaired tear out of the hinge. This is the inside of that same view looking, and you can see there's been a patch in there. The hinges have been replaced. I'm fine with that. You know, that's, you kind of expect to see that. What worries me more, and I've seen it on a couple of sugar chests, particularly over the years, where you know something has happened, but it's clear that they just ended up replacing a big chunk of the backboard instead of just kind of patching it in and making it work. That's when you start to evaluate a little more critically. If there's been more loss trying to repair something quite small than if it's just a small repair like this. So now we're looking at the side of a drawer, and you know, drawers get beat up, pulled in and out for 200 years, the wood shrinks, the wood expands. Here we have a pieced in bottom to the drawer. We also see a nail hole here where the dovetail, at least this dovetail, was getting loose, and so they drove a nail through it. Again, I see this all the time, and it doesn't really bother me. You know, it's just, if I was looking at a Massachusetts chest of drawers from 1790, I could find one that looked like it had barely been used. But in Kentucky, the volume of material that was made and has survived, most importantly, you do have to be more forgiving. So this kind of repair doesn't trouble me too much. Then we look inside a chest of drawers, and what you get is what's called the drawer support. These are usually let in from the back of the case, slid forward into what's called the drawer blade or the drawer divider. So this is, you know, the drawer, front of the drawer would rest on this. And then you get these guides, usually nailed, sometimes joined into the case sides. And what you're seeing with this one is really all original material, which is quite nice. More often than not, you'll see things like this, where something's happened to the drawer support, something's happened to the drawer guide, they've both been replaced. You see these shiny wire nails that have been driven through. But if you look around it, you know, the rest of the material didn't suffer from a big tear out or break of some kind. They're just replacing the parts that got worn. So we talk a little bit about silver, too, and some of the condition issues that one often encounters with silver. Does anyone want to guess what happened to this tablespoon?
Salt.
No. No. This is an old, this is probably old damage.
Fire.
No, this was, well, this could be from a dog. I've seen that. It could have been used while teething, potentially. It's hard to know who or what chewed on it, but that's what's happened here. And I see that with some regularity. The other thing with spoons, since we've got a nice detail here, you know, the weakest point of a spoon is the join between the handle and the bowl. And you always want to be, you look very carefully at what's going on here and then flip it over and look at the back. Because oftentimes this is where repairs will occur. Repairs usually done with silver solder. If it's a good repair, you'll barely know it. And you know, if it's a tablespoon from a fairly common maker, I'll move on. If it's a rare maker, then again, you give it some latitude if a repair like this has occurred at the stem. This is, you know, silver is a fairly soft metal, and, you know, Kentucky, the coin standard found in Kentucky means more or less, and scientifically this has played out to be the case, analyzing silver in this part of the world. It's 90% silver and 10% other, mostly copper. The copper makes the silver easier to work, among other things, makes it a little less expensive to produce, too. But this kind of wear is not at all uncommon. You know, being used over and over, if you're using your spoon to like cut whatever it is or dig through it, because the metal is fairly soft, you'll get wear there. And once in a while, you'll see a tablespoon that clearly was used by someone left-handed. And then it happens over here. But more often, as you'd expect, more often the wear is from these things being used by someone who's right-handed or using them in the right hand. You know, silver is an interesting material in a lot of ways, technically, but also its associations as a precious metal. Silver, like tall case clocks, which we'll talk about, like quilts sometimes, they take on these associations that are greater than the sum of their parts. They take on family memory, they become pieces that get passed down through the generations. And you'll see that sometimes with silver. This is a nice example. This is a cup in our collection made by William Hardman, who is based in Lexington. I want to make sure I get the inscriptions right. So this actually began its life in the early 19th century as a tumbler or a cup. Not a julep cup, a tumbler or a cup. When you look at inventories of the period, someone's inventory will say 6 silver cups or maybe 6 silver tumblers or just 6 tumblers, not julep cups. So this began its life just as a cup, but then later on something happened, which I think adds to its interest and value, honestly, as an historical object. And I know this is impossible to see. So silver is really hard to photograph. So, as I said, made by William Hardman of Lexington. So the inscriptions are at the top here is J.E.B. for John and Eliza or Elizabeth Hay Brand. And then the later inscription reads, to George Brand Duncan, son of Elizabeth Vertner, George Brand Duncan from his grandfather, George W. Brand. So what you see is the passage of this thing from the parents to their son and then going down to his grandson eventually. And at some point, I suspect when it went to the grandson, and when that happened, he would have been fairly young, just based on his life dates. That's when that handle was probably attached to the cup. So essentially converting this into a child's cup. And there are some, when you look at, with a handle like this, over time, if it originally had a handle, you'd start to see some strain happening where the handle was attached inside. You know, as it gets used, the handle starts to get shoved into the body a little bit. And you don't really see much of that with this at all. And, you know, this is so crisp, too, compared to the typical wear you see on the rest of it. Then you run into silver that's associated with this state that was being retailed here. This is a nice example, made originally as what's called an agricultural premium. So this was awarded at the Kentucky State Agricultural Society's 1859 annual gathering. We don't know what for. These things were given for the best horse or the best hogshead of tobacco, things like that at these agricultural fairs. And they would give cups, they would give pitchers. Sometimes you'd get a set, a pitcher, and a couple of cups. So this one we know from the inscription on it was for this Kentucky Agricultural Society fair. But then when we see the marks inside, we see John B. Aiken, who was in Danville, and then P.L. Kreider, Standard, Philadelphia. Peter L. Kreider ran a large silver shop in Philadelphia at the time that this piece was made. John B. Aiken was retailing this piece, and he was based in Danville. And that's not at all uncommon in the period. Really, some of the strongest trade connections, particularly in the clock and silversmithing business, was with Philadelphia. That doesn't surprise me that this was coming from Philadelphia. You know, the other major silver-making center as the 19th century went on became New York City. And this is an interesting story of, you know, how acquisitions are sometimes, as much as curators like to pretend that we know what we're doing, sometimes the best acquisitions I've made have been good timing and dumb luck. I mean, it's true. So this pitcher came up for auction. It's been now a number of years ago. Marked on the bottom for the Kinsey brothers. The Kinseys began their careers in Covington and then moved over to Cincinnati. I had a big shop and operation there for quite a while into the 19th century. But this, based on surviving Kinsey brothers' work, this came up at Christie's or Sotheby's, so long I forget, in New York, cataloged as the Kinseys, but I knew that wasn't the maker, that it was probably a New York piece. It had just gotten miscataloged. And lo and behold, we were able to get it. It sold for a much lower price than if it had been cataloged as New York. And we'd had it in the collection for a couple of years. I think it appeared in a Notice in Antiques or one of the sort of antiques magazines back then. And then I get a call from an antique dealer and estate auctioneer in Florida saying, you know, I found these two cups that I think go with that pitcher. I think they came out of the same family. And lo and behold, several years later, we were able to reunite the cups that go with this piece. And this was a presentation piece. I mean, you know, something this fancy with two cups, that's always the giveaway. It was made for a businessman in Mason County, in Maysville, named John Dobbins. And the inscription on the pitcher reads, "The farmers of Mason County to John P. Dobbins, a token of grateful regard to him whose public spirit created for us a market, and a testimonial to his fidelity as an agent, skill as a merchant, and usefulness as a citizen." And Dobbins was a very successful businessman, a merchant. He was involved. I think this relates to the role he played in getting the railroad to Maysville. And so he was presented this by at least the better, the more well-off farmers of Mason County in honor of his efforts. And here we see that picture. And then on the right, a picture virtually identical in the collection of the Cincinnati Art Museum. Lo and behold, we can connect this to a very prominent silversmithing firm of Gross, Jean, and Woodward in New York City at the time that this was made. So that tells me that even though this has the Kinsey Brothers marks, they were retailing this. This picture, the cups may have been made by the Kinseys. They're much more simple. But this picture was made in that major silversmithing center of New York City, found its way to Cincinnati, and then to Maysville, where it was given to John Dobbins. So context, you know, I think we're up to our last C. That's looking at, you know, what we know about pieces, or what we can kind of tease out of historical records, or family records, or how objects relate to one another. And obviously the easiest way is when you know who the maker is. I wish that happened more often. But this piece, we know from its family history, was made by Juliana Carroll of Maysville while she was a young woman. Beautiful needlework picture, although made from a pattern. This had a pre-printed pattern on it, which wasn't that unusual for the era. And then she followed the stitching. The scene is one that is based on a book by the English author Lawrence Sterne. His book was published in 1768, A Sentimental Journey Through France and Italy. And this is showing one of the scenes from that book. Maria, the main character in the book, is despondent by being jilted by her boyfriend. And the passage in the book that relates to this reads, "I discovered poor Maria sitting under a poplar. She was sitting with her elbow in her lap and her head leaning on one side within her hand." And, you know, melancholy scenes like that. And, you know, this piece dates really to about 1819, 1820. I mean, melancholy scenes like that we tend to associate with the later 19th century. But that kind of sentimentality was coming into popularity earlier.
Is this an embroidery or needlepoint?
Or cruel? You're asking the wrong man. No, I mean it'd be classified as needlepoint, essentially, following the pattern, and it's silk thread.
It's on canvas then.
It's on actually printed linen.
Oh.
Yeah. And here we see on the right that same scene painted by the well-known British painter Charles Landseer. From about 1836, so even later than this original needlepoint, you can see the durability of this story and the, you know, how it tugged at one's heartstrings. Family history is critically important and often hard to come by. You know, over the years, I have learned that no matter how odd or outrageous a history might be that comes with something, there's usually truth in it. And it's sort of digging down to discover that. Because, I mean, you know how, it's like, what, the game Telephone? You know, each generation kind of adds on to the story, the origin story of an object, but there's usually truth there. This one's a little more straightforward, thankfully. This is a wonderful, what we would call a sugar press. Why is it called a sugar press? This bottom form, two drawers over two doors, paneled construction, typically turned legs. That was a form in the period that was often known as a press. And presses could just have a top. They could have a bookcase on top. They could be used almost like a sideboard in a way. Or more unusual instances, they could have a box plunked down on top, and then it became a sugar press. This is quite late. This is probably from the 1840s or maybe even into the early 1850s, coming out of Garrett County. This came to the collector with an intact family history that could be documented. And even more interesting, this family lived just down the road from a cabinet maker named Henry Spanauer. Henry Spanauer was born in North Carolina. He worked in East Tennessee and then ended up in Garrett County. And it's interesting that time in Tennessee, the sugar press form is more often associated with Tennessee than with Kentucky. They do turn up here, but not as often as they seem to down in Tennessee. So that helps tie this into a nice package. We know the family. We know they had this geographic connection with this maker who had also worked in Tennessee where he may have learned this form. So related groups, you know, the way furniture and other objects are made can often provide you clues to start to group things together. You may never discover who made them by name, but between that and finding ones that do have family histories, you can start to localize things. And one of the really exciting and interesting things for me, particularly with Kentucky furniture, is it becomes very micro-regional within the state. You know, a cabinet maker will come to a county, develop a style that becomes unique and associated with that place, or a certain form becomes popular in one area, and then other cabinet makers start to make the same form. And I think that's just a product of Kentucky's development. You know, this was a state, even before it was a state, it was a place where people were coming to hopefully seek their fortune, or at least to do better than they did where they were coming from. And that was certainly true of artisans. You know, they were coming here from all kinds of places, east, you know, northeast, the south, England, Ireland, and they were coming here and creating this really what became a collision of all these different bases of knowledge, the tastes of their customers, creating objects that became really quite distinctive. And these two chests of drawers are from a larger group, many of which have histories in the Madison County area, and their inlay, I mean, there's no mistaking it. It is so idiosyncratic. Amazing vine and leaf. I mean, vine and leaf is a form of inlay decor on American furniture that you see in a lot of places. This maker had a very distinctive approach to that. The way the corners of the drawers are treated, you know, you see this still retains some of the green tinting of the inlay. Inlays in the period were often colored. I think we don't appreciate that because so often that color is just gone. And, you know, here you can see where the inlay's been charred a little bit to give it some sense of depth or three-dimensionality. That's something else that goes on. That tends to survive a little bit better, but it too, this charring can bleach out over time. But the colorant here, which had to be copper-based, really has held up well over time. So when you can start to assemble things into groups and understand where they're coming from, it does give us a better sense of what was going on in different parts of the state. And here we see the bottom part of the fronts of both of those. You can see, you know, what the vine grows out of is a little bit different, but there's no mistaking, you know, these coming from the same cabinet-making shop. So, putting it all together, when you think of caliber, of condition, of context, just wanted to share with you some fairly recent acquisitions at the Speed. This isn't even on view yet. I'm going to put it on view in May. I'm trying to raise money to get it conserved a little bit. You'll see what it needs in just a minute. So if any of you fall in love with that, come see me afterwards. I'll be happy to empty your pocketbooks. But this is a beautiful sideboard that came out of an estate here in Louisville. I'd known about it for years. The gentleman who owned it, who was a very organized person, was kind enough to put a note in it that said the Speed Art Museum is interested in this. And when he passed away, his executor called me, and we were able to add it to our collection. What makes this great? Oops, I was pushing the wrong button. In terms of caliber, well, when you look at it, you can see across this facade with wonderful sense of movement. You see that kind of play of convex and concave in other furniture making areas in this period. So this piece dates, it could even be pre-1800, I'd say, 1800, 1810, something like that. But there seemed to be a taste, particularly in the Lexington area, for pieces that have a lot of movement across the facades of them. And this certainly is a great example of that. I mean, you look at the masterful quality of the stringing here at the bottom, these highly, highly figured veneers that are being used here. This may be cherry, it may not. It's very hard to identify. But that makes this piece exciting too. If we were to see this firsthand, you'd see that the cabinet maker took the extra step of making this leg concave to accept this beautiful panel of inlay. And that's just the kind of extra that speaks to a cabinet maker who knew what they were doing and could manage that, and B, a clientele that were sophisticated enough in a place like Lexington, which was such an important urban center in America in the early 19th century, a customer with the means and the taste to know that that's what I want. Condition, it really is in very good condition. You can see there have been some efforts, there's some fills here, there have been some efforts to deal with where this veneer is splitting. So when I would take this to a conservator, I would just have them very lightly clean this, and I mean literally like with very mild soap and water and Q-tips, and then probably try to improve the look of some of these old fills, which are a little visually distracting. And there are ways to do that that are completely reversible. But other than that, the condition of this piece is so wonderful. I mean, it's like an archaeological site. We can go in and start to understand the woods that are being used on this with technical analysis. We can take samples of the Finnish history, which will read like archaeology. There'll be layer, 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 to see how many layers there are. We can start to identify some of the materials that were being used for the Finnish. When we look inside, it has this remnants of this red wash that was probably being applied to the surface to really enhance its color. This could be original, this could be a little bit later, though here you see it has enough patination and oxidation to it that if this was done, it was done after it was made, it was done very early on. I suspect it was done originally to enhance the color. And this, you do see this occasionally. You see it going on the sides of the drawers, the inside of the case. So here, there's another area where we do some sampling of this and start to understand the pigments, and maybe that would give us a sense of when those were applied. The drawers, remember we talked about bashed up drawer edges? This one, all original. This was very lightly used over its history. The gentleman who owned it acquired it in the 1970s, had it in his dining room. Bless his heart, he knew he didn't want it in the light. He had it on a between two windows on a north wall. So it really was not exposed to light. And because of that, because he was so careful with it, it is so remarkably well preserved. And then context. Well, I said this came from Lexington. I mean, some of that is based on that very highly figured facade, but there are other clues too that begin to point to Lexington based on other surviving examples. So now we're looking at the back of it, and what we're seeing here are tenons, so projections on the back of the dividers that divide the case up, projecting through the back. Not that unusual. You will see tenons come through the back, but what is unusual with this, and this photo's been enhanced a little bit, they project all the way through, and then they drove a wedge into it to try to tighten that joint up even more. I have never seen that in another piece of Kentucky case furniture, a sideboard, except in this, which I saw way back in 2008, that had a history in the central part of the state. It had ended up with a dealer in Richmond, Virginia. This center section is identical to the sideboard we were just looking at. This one uses rounded ends rather than, those convex ends. This adds what are called tambour doors. So these are little vertical reeds of wood glued down onto canvas that then kind of roll back into the case when you slide it open. But I have no doubt that this is from the same cabinet making shop as the Speed sideboard, or this piece which sold at auction back in 2017 in Knoxville, Tennessee. It came out of a Nashville estate. It had a history of being from the Owensboro area, but when you start to break that down, the family name that was associated with it goes back to Lexington and to Fayette County. You see that same use of these very highly figured veneers, you know, this interest in shaping, has fairly similar stringing along the bottom edge. So here we're starting to put together a group of very sophisticated sideboards that I think, again, probably survived because they were practical over time, but also must have had meaning to generation after generation of the families that own these, because they are such beautiful and imposing objects. So silver, these are two acquisitions made late 2017. These had descended in a family, a family with Kentucky origins, but one branch of the family had ended up in New York. These were sold at auction in New York. And what's interesting about these is they both descend in the same family. Inscriptions bear that out. It bears the mark of a silversmith in Lexington named George Stewart. This bears the mark of a large Baltimore silver manufactory called Kirk & Son. This is from both of these from the early 1840s. This very elaborate raised or repoussé style of silver is often associated with Kirk and with Baltimore, although the style spread to New York and elsewhere. And you see that same sort of style going here on this piece. I mean, the caliber is amazing. You know, this is very unusual in having this family scene as part of the raised decoration. And lo and behold, remember what that looks like, lo and behold, it comes from this English painting. This is actually a print of the painting by an artist named George Moreland, who is an 18th century artist, but his paintings, particularly through prints, remain popular into the 19th century. And it, again, you see this family scene that was being played out onto the silver. I love this. It's like that's either a young boy, could be a young girl, riding her brother around with a riding crop, I might add. But a great family scene. And why does that make this even more interesting? Because this Monteith and one other were presented by a mother to her children when they were having young children. So it's so appropriate, and I suspect almost that she probably must have had a print of that George Moreland painting that she took to the silversmith and said, I want this imagery. I doubt the silversmith would have had that himself, although you never know. It's so specialized. Condition, you can see that there's been, you know, polishing silver is not a good thing, because when you polish silver, you're removing silver, basically. And the more you do it, you see the features starting to flatten out on the high points of the faces here. It's not bad, though. You can see how deeply oxidized these areas are. And when this was originally made, I can almost guarantee you that many of these areas would not have been polished out. That the silversmith, that would have come out of the silversmith's shop with some of this oxidation going on, really to highlight this beautiful raised decoration. Context. So as I said, these went from a mother to her children. And they were gifts of Elizabeth or Eliza Brand to her son, this one, William Moses Brand, and another was given to her daughter, who confusingly was also named Eliza or Elizabeth. And if you remember that cup with the handle that I showed earlier, that was from this same family. So clearly silver had played an important part within the family and within sort of remembering the family across generations. And the pitcher also bears an inscription as well. It was owned originally by Mrs. Brand and her husband John, and it passed on to their granddaughter when they died in 1850. And there's an inscription that bears that out. So, this is a great painting, by the way, one of my favorites. A painting of Sally Ward, a remarkable figure. You'll have to come visit her. She's off view now, but we'll go back on view in April. An amazing woman with an amazing life story. I couldn't even do it justice. Of course, our Kentucky Gallery, I hope you all come to see that. We will be rotating part of the gallery in early April, so I suggest you come either now or after April 15th. We'll be starting to change the gallery out the second week of April, as we often do. We're going to do a little bit of focus of the material culture of Lexington and move, swap out some other things as well. So there'll be some new things to see in the gallery. And then our current exhibition. How many of you have seen it? See, I'm going to put you all on the spot. Oh my God. Yay, thank you. So this is an exhibition that's on view until June. We'll have a symposium on Saturday, May the 18th. That will be myself and the collaborators I worked on with this exhibition. And this emerged again out of a kind of object that clearly has this resonance, this sentimental resonance, which leads to its survival. And they're practical too. You know, the ones with metal movements do run reasonably well as long as you get them, you know, spruced up and cleaned every so often. So there's a large body of these tall case clocks out there. Some of my colleagues were doing research on certain makers. So it really all came together to be able to do what was really a fun exhibition to work on. And tall case clocks in Kentucky and elsewhere are really remarkable testimonies to the artisanry, the economic history, the trade history of the era. Because when you look at one of these objects, you have a case that's locally made. This one happens to be from an anonymous Lexington cabinet making shop. We know Lexington from related examples and family histories of pieces. But then the dials, by and large, not exclusively, by and large, are of English manufacture, made in the English Midlands, centered around Birmingham. And whether the whole movement, parts of the movements, that's, you know, so the clock works, those are often English made as well. And I think more often than not, it was a mix of a local artisan who understood clock making, who could acquire English components and assemble these movements. And there's at least one clock in the exhibition that has a fully assembled English movement that just came here. So, you know, even into really the 1830s, 1840s, you know, industry, metal industries, we still didn't compete very well with the English. They had a big head start on us, as someone said to me before my lecture, and that's very true. So there are 27 tall case clocks in the exhibition, and then this one at the end, which is a dwarf tall case clock from the South Union Shaker community. But I, you know, my concern when I started working on this was, well, you know, is this just the strange obsession of myself and the people I was working on this with? I'd only seen these clocks really kind of one at a time as we were photographing them. But then once they were all in the gallery, it's just amazing the diversity of them. And again, as I said earlier, that speaks to the genius of the artisans and also some of these regional tendencies that start to crop up. And again, inlay and other devices are one way to look at that. Let's see. So this very distinctive charred inlay is associated with the Adair County area. You know, this is also from a clock associated with Adair County, but from a different maker. But there's clearly this taste in that part of the state for these really bold use of inlay in the furniture. The Speed has an amazing corner cupboard from Adair County that's just splashed with inlay as well. So again, you get these very distinctive regional tastes going on. Beautiful, very high style. This is from the base, the front of the base of one of the clocks. Probably made in Lexington, maybe in Frankfurt for John Brown, one of our first senators. You know, some of these devices associated with work coming out of Frankfurt. This from a remarkable cabinet maker named William Lowry, who clearly one of the working in Frankfurt in the early part of the 19th century, incredible cabinet making, just in terms of design and the execution. And thanks to this exhibition, someone just emailed me some photos the other day of another clock that we can connect to William Lowry, I have no doubt. And as I say, you know, the movements and the timekeeping aspect of these are a whole other story. So let's see, this is English. This is an American-made dial, probably made in Boston or Philadelphia. This one coming out of Philadelphia. And then you get these two. This is from that dwarf shaker clock. This is from a shaker clock associated with Pleasant Hill. You can see just the stark difference of aesthetic that, of course, we associate with shakers as part of their belief system, this idea in simplicity. But if you come and look at these clock cases, they have a little bit more going on than, say, clock cases that would have come out of some of the northeastern shaker communities, which tended to be more austere. And at South Union, there is this history of them kind of being told that, you know, you're not, by the elders coming from the northeast sometimes, that, you know, you're not being very shaker, however they said that, just in their material culture. But of course, in places like Mercer County, where Pleasant Hill was, or Logan County, where South Union was, you know, a lot of the people coming into that community were coming from the surrounding area, and they were artisans, and those artisans brought with them the way they knew how to design and make things. So you do even get a very distinctive Kentucky take on the shaker experience, too, and you can see that in our exhibition as well. And then there are the movements. Don't ask me too many questions about these. This is a complete other science unto itself, and I was blessed to have a colleague on this project who really understands the insides of these. This is a fairly typical type of movement. These brass and steel movements run for 8 days. They strike the hour. They'll often have a calendar dial. You saw maybe the moon dials. I'll go back. They often will have these moon dials that could be calibrated for the 29.5 day lunar cycle each month. And then you get American-made wooden movements as well, coming out of New England and Cincinnati, being put into Kentucky-made cases, particularly cases associated with one maker in Lexington. This is the movement in that small South Union clock. It does not strike, whereas most of these others do strike. And an English bell, even the bells could be imports. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions anyone might have now, or you can come up and see me afterwards. Yeah?
The sugar chests have that big, whatever you call it, container thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the box on top.
The box, thank you. What was that used for? Is that where you stored the sugar?
Well, that's the theory. Typically, they're divided at least once. I've seen some that have two dividers. So you might have brown sugar in one compartment, white sugar in another. I think, you know, tea and tea boxes and coffee, green tea, black tea. I mean, that might have been stored in there as well. I think we tend to project backwards on how people use things based on a very simplistic sense of how they use things. If you had a box like that that you could open up and it had these compartments, if you weren't filling it with something, one thing, I can guarantee you put something else in there. And I think, you know, I think the way objects were used then are probably not that different from the way we use them today. Yeah?
When I noticed on the clocks, mm-hmm.
Oh, the Arabic and Roman numerals?
Yes.
They tend to overlap in the early 19th century. So you see both with Kentucky clocks that were made from, say, 1800, 1810 into the 1820s. Eventually, the Arabic numerals became more the norm, but they did overlap for quite a period.
I just was wondering when they started using
That's a good question. Yeah, you do, if anyone smarter than me out there knows that, they can answer that question. But yeah, I mean, that is the rule that you see with these. You'll see, four strokes for the four. Any other questions? Uh-oh. Julie?
What did they say?
What?
What did the people of early Kentucky say?
I couldn't do a whole thing on chairs. Chair making could be its own presentation. By and large, I think what kind of chairs were people using? Turn chairs, often locally made, and chair turning is even more idiosyncratic than cabinet making. A chair maker, the way they turned, kind of the patterns they liked, are almost like fingerprints sometimes. We might not know who they are, but we know where they were working. But then, you get fancy chairs, so painted furniture that was being made locally. I suspect some of that was probably coming into the state, too, from centers like even Pittsburgh, which had a big chair manufacturing industry. Easy enough to ship even knockdown chairs downriver and then assemble them on site. That happened, too. If you were fancy, I have no doubt that there were probably more high-style chairs being made here that have trickled away, that may have looked like just as easily as if they'd been made in Pennsylvania or Maryland or Virginia, that have kind of gotten away from us. But when you look at paintings of the period, you often see with more well-off clientele, they often will have painted furniture, fancy furniture. Yeah?
Is the collection mostly maybe donated to you all back?
I would say, across the museum, and this would be true of virtually every American museum, 90% plus of our collection has been gifts over the years, probably closer to 95% really on a mathematical basis. And that's the norm of the American museum world. It's the generosity of people through the decades, like Mr. and Mrs. No, who really wanted us to be able to have a true Kentucky gallery, and so gave us their collection, and then we built our Kentucky gallery during our renovation. So no, it's by and large it's a gift. I do make some purchases, but by and large it's through gift, yeah. Yes?
Is there still an acquisition group at the Speed Museum?
There are a couple, yeah. So she asked if there are groups that, membership support groups dedicated to acquisitions. Yes, we have one that deals with painting and sculpture. We have one that deals with contemporary art. I run a group that y'all can join called Speed Design, which looks at decorative arts and design and architecture and all kinds of things. And members of that group help support things I do, whether that's acquisitions or exhibitions like this clock exhibition. So they support me in various ways with what I try to do with that aspect of our collection. Is that it? I'll stick around, happy to answer questions afterwards. Thank you all for coming.